We here at the Making Movies is Hard podcast are very happy that the WGA and the AMTPA have come to an agreement, but the SAG-AFTRA strike continues. If you would like to help them, please go to SAG-AFTRA Foundation's Emergency Financial Assistance Program, sagaftra.foundation/donate, and click the link.
You know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Purcell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker. My first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital DVD, Tubi, and on Amazon Prime, I saw. And then also, you can watch my short film, Parka, on Vimeo.
Woo-woo! I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has made two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life, and I'm making my third one called Best Friends Forever. I'm a producer's rep who likes to talk about distribution, and I used to work at Sundance. But this week, we welcome horror film writing legend Dennis Pauly on the show, writer of such cult classics as Reanimator and From Beyond. I like to say From Beyond like that. I don't know if you do that too, Ulrich, but From Beyond. To talk about his latest feature, Suitable Flesh. After that, we play another round of You're the Expert. But first, Ulrich, how are you?
Doing well. On furlough from work right now, so that's like a very weird feeling to be.
Oh.
Yeah, it's the second time I've been on furlough with these guys, and it's supposed to be temporary. We'll see how it goes.
Oh, gosh.
And yeah, what else? Oh, you know, I really wanted to congratulate you. 5,000 hits on your short. That's amazing.
We're almost at 53. We're almost at 5,300.
So are you, what is your process for that? Are you doing things for it every day, or
no,
is it
I've done nothing
like
for like 10 days.
Oh,
this
wow.
This is all, I actually looked at the analytics of YouTube, and the majority of views are from YouTube recommendations and up next on YouTube. So It's YouTube is churning the view count up. I kept on trying to connect with the witches of Facebook, and they did not want me.
Oh.
And so really, I'm very lucky that YouTube has decided to encourage it in some way automatically.
It's funny because I was like reading some of the comments, and they're like, yeah, I'm a witch and this has never happened to me or something.
I know. It's like, I think witches like it, but I don't think the witch admins on the Facebook groups want me to spam their users, which I get it. I would be mad at me too for trying to get views.
That's funny. Well, good job.
Thank you.
Makes me think that I should switch to Facebook, or not Facebook, to YouTube from Vimeo. But I'm still like kind of holding out for a YouTube channel to take the movie. So
yeah.
I saw another one the other day that looked pretty promising, but I haven't reached out to them yet. But yeah, I don't know. It is what it is, but I'm very impressed with you. It's
Thank
pretty
you.
Awesome.
Very
it impressed. Just goes to show that like if you do put your mind to it, like, you know, you may not get 50,000 in the next couple months, but the fact that you got to 5,000 is like really a big deal that you should be very proud of, you know.
I am proud of it, though. I think if you dip into the analytics, it's like the majority of YouTube videos don't really last beyond the first 30 seconds. Like it's like 63% of viewers of YouTube shorts like turn off after 30 seconds. So you're like, well, and this is for mine, but they said it was average for YouTube viewers. So it's like maybe people on Vimeo are actually watching yours, Ulrich. You know what I mean? Like,
I don't know.
That's pretty depressing. That's not great for
I love how you always find the negative thing within the thing. It's like, oh yeah, we have 5,000 hits, but you know they're probably only watching like 60 seconds of it, so that's really sucks. It's come on, be happy.
Oh my god,
proud.
You're so, everyone is so lucky they're not my husband. Everyone in the world is so lucky, because this is reflective of like every conversation I have at home. You're right. I one day will be able to see the bright side of life. I think right now I really think it's important not to get too cocky about anything. And so this is my way of making sure that I don't ever get too cocky by self-abuse.
I feel like too cocky and, you know, just being happy and, you know, proud of yourself is like there's a line there. Yeah, a very thick line. Not a thin line, a thick line. But yeah, but anyways, also, I'm just, you know, I we talked about this offline the other day, but I'm like scrolling through your comments and wow, amazing comments. People love this thing. That's so great.
People are very sweet. I was going to give an example of the one negative comment, but now I'm stopping myself because I'm trying to not say that. I'm not saying it. Everything's fine. They're very
nice. Reading the comments on the trailer for the alternate, it's like, you know, you'll have like four nice things and then it'll be like two bad and then like one nice and then three bad and then two nice and then one bad. And you're like, okay. But like yours is like nice all the way down. So, you know, I'm sure there are some negative ones in there. But, you know, I mean, I feel like another thing to be very proud of and happy about.
Congratulations.
Oh, man. Yeah. So what else is going on with me?
Yeah.
I mean, amidst this whole, you know, like not being at my job right now thing, I've been thinking about like what I want my next 5-10 years to look like a person. And I really want to get into feature film editing as like my job, because like I did it once on my movie and, you know, I get some editing compliments on that film in general. And then like my producer Jeff was like, yeah, man, like you edited that movie. That's great. You could totally edit whatever you want to edit. It's like, oh, OK. So I basically just need to like try to hunt and find the opportunities to edit movies, you know. So I know a lot of our listeners are making features or have made features. So if anybody needs an editor for a feature, hit me up. I am in. I'm down. I'm ready. I got reached out to a friend of mine who I worked with like 14 years ago on my first feature I ever worked on, and she's making her first feature. Ooh. And so I was like, hey, yo, like when you get to editing, I want to edit your movie. And she's like, yeah, you're on the top of the list. But she's not the director, so like obviously you get to talk to the director and figure out like what the director's plans are, you know, all that stuff. But still, like I'm basically now just gonna be like, you know, anytime anyone's making a feature, just be like, yes, I want to edit it. Let me edit your movie.
I love that. I love people in post-production. I always think the post-production people are the best people in the film industry. That's been my experience. But also editing is just the most rewarding, creatively enriching and rewarding part of filmmaking. Like that feeling of things clicking. You only get that, I think, in editing because it's final. Whereas when you're on set, it's always that question of, will it cut together? I'm not positive. Who knows? So it's all the magic for me is in an editorial. So well done.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Well, we'll see. I gotta get into it first, you know. But I was just thinking about like what my life could look like and how awesome would it be if like my job was just to edit features and I just did that from home and edited like, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 features a year. Like that would be great. I'd love to do that. That would be amazing, you know. So yeah, I'm also willing to work for a little less on the first one because I haven't been hired to do it before. So
yeah,
people,
he's a great deal. Know. Good bargain.
And I'll work really hard. I promise.
You will.
But you know what you don't have to work hard at is going to our Patreon page. Go to www.patreon.com/MMIH podcast. That's where you can support the show. Make sure that we keep this thing going. We have some really exciting guests coming up, especially our 450th episode is going to be bomb. Oh my God. I can't wait for everyone to hear this interview. Should we announce it now who it is, or should we should we save it?
Save it.
Okay. It's a good one. I don't think I'm overhyping it by any means. It's really, really going to be fun. $1.99 a month will get you access to the whole back catalog. That's 350 episodes that you cannot listen to anywhere else. So make sure to check that out.
Well, without any further jibber jabber, here's our chat with Dennis Pauly. So our first question is, if you feel comfortable, give us the elevator pitch for Suitable Flesh.
The elevator pitch?
Well, I mean, really just the log line.
I am notoriously the worst pitch person. When Stuart Gordon and I worked together all those years, we started out doing pitches together, but luckily I was in New York and he was in LA, so we rarely did them together. But when we did, he would eventually afterwards, he shut me out. I was so terrible at it. I don't do pitches in elevate, you know, in your office, much less in the elevator. But that, to try to do it without spoiler alerts is impossible. Whatever you say about Suitable Flesh, whatever you say about it, will spoil some aspect of it. partly because it's multi-genre. It's not just horror. It's not just horror comedy. It's also, and Joe Lynch, the director, really got this. It's also sort of a neo-noir thriller. Going back to the original H.P. Lovecraft story that it's based on, The Thing on the Doorstep, it's a mind-swapping tale in a context of cosmic horror. But of course, it's not just mind-swapping. When you mind swap, you body swap. So it's a body swapping tale as well. And we try to dig into that. But it's not just that. It's a gender swapping tale as well. And that leads to all kinds of identity, insanity, madness issues that work themselves out in the maddest possible way, which we, on the one hand, we owe to Lovecraft. On the other, we invented entirely ourselves. It was the maddest adventure. It was the maddest mind adventure that we could imagine. And by we, I mean me, the director, Joe Lynch, and our producer and one of the stars of the film, Barbara Crampton, who was a great joy to work with again. So if you want to have your mind melted and swapped it with a mad film, go see Suitable Flesh.
All right. Well, you said you're not great at pitches, but clearly, like, the goal of the pitch is to get someone interested. And I am, like, sucked in, right? Like,
that was an elevator ride all the way to the basement and back up again. I mean, the elevator part is what, you know, I can talk about our film and all the films I did with Stuart Gordon. I can talk about them for, how much time you got? You got a month. But the fact is, you know, doing it efficiently in the elevator model is way, way past my capabilities. I'm way too long-winded for that.
Well, Ulrich gets set up. I'll just keep on asking questions. Some of these questions are physical production questions. We don't know if you were on set or not, so feel free to, you know.
I was never on set.
Oh.
I probably have about 14 or 15 credits, film and TV, maybe actually one or two more than that. And I was never on set.
For any of them?
None. Zero. One, I live in New York. They were all shot either in Hollywood or in Europe. I was 3,000 miles away, no matter where they were. And the other thing is, as close a friend as I was to Stuart Gordon, he was my best friend for the better part of my life. When he was making movies, it's just a given that nobody wants the writer there. You know, Brian Usna, our faithful producer, the true believer in horror. Among us, he was the true believer. He, you know, who became a good friend. You know, they just didn't invite me to the set. You know, and let's face it, no producer wants writer, and the directors don't want the writer on the set. What do you mean? Why did you deliver that line that way? Wait, that's not what I wrote. That's not what I saw when I wrote that. No, nobody wants to hear that. And the fact is, it's a better film for it. You know, I'm thinking specifically of a couple of lines from Reanimator that Jeffrey Combs, the brilliant Jeffrey Combs, ad-libbed. And I get credit for those. So what do I want to be on set for? I mean, if they're going to do a better job, they're going to rewrite my scenes and make them better. You know, I don't need to be there. Two, I don't even want to be there. On the other hand, I always wanted to be on set. I actually, back in our youths, I used to act with Stuart in some of his early theater in college. When we met in high school and we had a satire group, we discovered that we had the same sense of humor and that our heroes were the Second City theatrical comedy group in Chicago. And we started writing bits and sketches ourselves. We started performing them on the coffee house circuit in Chicago. Actually, we were professional comedians in high school. And it was great fun. So I loved being on stage. I loved being a performer. There's nothing quite like performing a line that you wrote and having a live audience laugh, you know, at you and with you. It was terrific. So in several of our scripts, I wrote an extra little part that I could play. And I would have, you know, and it would be sort of agreed with Stuart when I was writing that this would be, you know, I would come out and play this. They'd fly me out. And it was always the first thing cut. That little character was always, never important enough to the plot to keep. And of course, our budgets were always low. We worked in low budget, in the low budget world. So, and that's the other reason I wasn't invited to the set. It's, we worked on very strict budgets. I mean, look at Stuart's movies. They're not only brilliant, they're beautiful. Stuart, when I met him, was a art student, and in his early films, he used to draw his own storyboards. You know, look at the composition of his shots. They're gorgeous. They're beautiful. You know, his films aren't only frightening and funny. They're artistic. So the money that they spent always got on the screen. It wasn't about, dragging the writer there, et cetera. And Stuart, most of the time, was my co-writer. We collaborated. We were co-authors on a number of the pieces that he filmed. So a writer was always there. Stuart was there. So they really didn't need me. And if you don't need somebody in a low budget film,
they're out.
They don't get there. And as I've said, for a number of reasons, it was better that I wasn't. They should spend that. They should spend that X number of thousands of dollars it would cost to fly me out and put me up to get it on screen. And I've had a very fortunate career in the fact that by they, I mean all the other collaborators I worked with, and primarily Stuart and the actors. But you got to give a shout out to some of the special effects guys that, they did great work and it's made me look good.
Well, I mean, it kind of answers a few of the next questions that we have in our beginning round.
I'm actually very good at that. If you ask me one question, I'll talk long enough to answer five or six of them. So just, scroll down and find another one.
Well, we have no shortage of questions for you. I'm going to jump to how long did you spend working on the film from, script stage until now? How long was the process for you for Suitable Flesh? Yeah.
That is an excellent question, because I started that script in the mid late 90s. Mm. So the answer to that question is something like 23 years.
Nice.
25 years. Stuart was shooting a couple of our movies in Europe. He was shooting Castle Freak, and then he went to do Dagon, and they were both shot in Europe. And while he was shooting them, we were looking for the next Lovecraft to adapt, because that was our brand. We were the Lovecraft adapters. So we had both always liked, that was another thing we discovered when we met each other in high school, that we really liked reading, we really liked movies, we really liked sci-fi and horror. We were both really good students. Stuart was the secretary of his graduating class, and I was an honor student in science and math. He was in art. But we, a couple of times we would cut class. And when we cut class, it was to go see the newest Hammer film, the newest Christopher Lee Dracula film, or the newest American International Lovecraft adaptation. So we were always, not Lovecraft, they adapted Poe. Very few people adapted Lovecraft. That's why we ended up doing, that's why we chose him. So we were looking at the next Lovecraft to do, and we both very much liked the story, The Thing on the Doorstep. It's got a little more narrative to it than a lot of Lovecraft's work. Our film From Beyond and Lovecraft's story From Beyond, we tell that whole story in the pre-credit sequence. Mm. That whole story is told before the credits. So the rest of the film is just what we imagined would happen. And Lovecraft not only lets you, he challenges you, he begs you to imagine the worst possible things you can imagine given what he's written. And we did. That's what we did in From Beyond. But Thing on the Doorstep had a little more narrative to it. Stuart was always a great storyteller. Stuart was, in our collaborations, Stuart was the strong storyteller, and I was the character and dialogue guy. So he was very much attracted to the deeper and more profound narrative that he thought there was in The Thing on the Doorstep. And I thought the characters were great. because the characters were swapping minds and bodies back and forth and following the narrator, trying to follow the characters was fascinating and frightening. So we liked that story very much and decided that would be the next one we'd adapt. So while he was in Europe, I wrote the script. He came back. I gave it to him. He liked it. He put his producer's hat on and tried to get it produced. He showed it to some finance people and it was optioned, but it never got made. They couldn't finance it. About 5 years later, he schlepped it around again because we believed in it. We tweaked it a little. He again got it optioned, but again, it couldn't find financing and it didn't get made. And a few years later, a couple of actors were interested in it. It was optioned again, but couldn't find the funding and it didn't get made. And all of those times, the feedback we got was, this is not getting made for the same reason. And I'll let you, once you've seen the movie, guess what it is. But I put it in a drawer. I got a big drawer full of undone things, unfinished stories and unproduced scripts. And it sat there. Every once in a while, I brought it out. But if you followed Stewart's career, he went on to sort of move from making horror films to making these neo-noir films. David Mamet's Edmund. Oh, Stewart does a brilliant job with that. Stuck. Stuck is a terrific movie. King of the Ants. He was making these really dark noir films. And then he moved back to the theater, his first love, and did some brilliant theater work in L.A. over the last decade of his life, including Reanimator the Musical. And that was so much. If you can imagine that, that was mad and more fun than you can imagine. Anyway, that script sat there. Then, unfortunately, during the pandemic, Stewart passed away very close to the beginning of the pandemic. And I was involved in several Zoom memorials for him during the early days of the pandemic and reconnected with Barbara Crampton, who was the terrific acting jobs in some of our early films. And she had become, besides being historically famous scream queen, and with a long acting career in a number of different genres, she had become a producer, a low-budget horror producer, and asked me if I had any scripts in the drawer. And of course, that was on top. I pulled it out. I gave it to her, and she loved it. She optioned it. She was able to connect Joe Lynch to it, which pretty much assured that it was going to get done. And Joe was able to attach Heather Graham to it, which at that point, it's a done deal. That movie's going to get made. And that's the process by which that film got made, which is long, arduous. It's not that different from the process of a number of films. I've had a couple other films that took 10 and 13 years, a couple other scripts that took 10 and 13 years to be produced. But if a story's good, it doesn't stop being good. You know, maybe our culture changed. So the objection to financiers' objections to it were no longer as relevant as they had been. Maybe Barbara just had more producer chops than other people did who optioned it earlier. But again, very lucky. I've been very lucky that a number of the scripts I've written have these lives of their own where they just speak to somebody, even after multiple rejections, which is the Hollywood norm, and get produced, you know. So that's the process, but I'm sure that's nobody else's process. You know, everybody else has an agent that's schlepping their scripts around. I haven't had an agent in decades. To some degree, Stewart was my agent, you know, because I collaborated with him and he had a viable and vital career. And that even spilled over into working with Barbara, which has also been a joy. She's terrific. It's probably not a process anybody can model theirs on, but it works. And the fact probably is that everybody's process is different. Everybody, you know, the way a script sort of swims through the shark infested seas to ultimately be done and produced and successfully get a theatrical or a streaming release. It's always an interesting story of its own. Did that answer another six or seven?
It did, but Ulrich, I'm sure, has more to ask.
Yeah. Well, now that the movie is done and out, I'm assuming you've seen it. If there was one thing that you could change about the way the movie came out, what would that one thing be?
I'd be in it, I actually wanted to play, there's a pathologist in it, and I wanted to play the pathologist, but happily it's played by Graham Skipper, who is a terrific genre actor who has a history with Stuart Gordon. He played Herbert West in Reanimator the Musical and was terrific. And it's a much better film for that. But I originally saw him. You know how you see certain people in certain roles? I saw myself in that, and it didn't help. It was, would I change anything? That's a dangerous thing to say, because I'm so grateful to the performers for their performances. Very difficult. They're mind swapping. You know, Judah Lewis, who's in this film, who I had not known before, a young actor, he plays essentially four different characters, and he's terrific at it. He's just great. And he sells every one of them. And it's a monumental breakthrough performance. It's wonderful. To say nothing of Heather. Heather Graham plays three characters and does a terrific job. You know, it's wonderful work that they do. And as I said, it's a multi-genre film. It's got noir elements to it that Joe liked. It also has what I call saxophone scenes. Where, you know, that are steamy sex scenes. And if you didn't guess before, that was the reason it didn't get made those three other times it was optioned. We got the note that there was too much sex, and Stuart and I never understood that. I mean, we didn't even understand the sentence. What do you mean too much sex? I don't know how those words work together. You know, especially in Lovecraft, people say, you know, Lovecraft is sort of asexual. There aren't women in his stories, although The Thing on the Doorstep has one of his finest and fullest female characters, if you think she's female. You know, we have crossed the line several times in Lovecraft adaptations of adding a female character, especially, for example, in From Beyond, where the central character is the protagonist, is Barbara Crampton's character, Catherine McMichaels, the psychiatrist, and she plays a psychiatrist in this film. And so there was a certain synergy in the writing there. But the fact is, Lovecraft's most profound fear is what happens to you. He's written about the maddest monsters you can imagine, the old ones, the deep ones, the Shoggoths. But actually, the fundamental fear in Lovecraft is the fear of what you can become yourself, that you somehow have the monster in you, and it can come out of you. And if you know Lovecraft's life, it came out of him many times. But what he was always afraid of in his lifetime was there was insanity in his family, and he was afraid he was going to be insane. It was going to make him insane, and he was going to lose his rationality and his ability to write, which was his identity. He was going to lose his identity. That's the fundamental fear in almost all of Lovecraft. And it goes back to your genetic past, which means it goes back to some sex act somewhere between you and between your progenitors, one of whom at least had to be a mad person, if not a monster. So that fundamental fear is a fundamental fear of sexuality. And we just brought that out onto the screen. Lovecraft's writing is very suggestive. He suggests without really showing you very often. Film is expressionistic. It's imagery. You have to show what's there. So we tried to pull that out and show that. And one of the things we had to show was the sexuality inherent, the sexual fear, the sexual panic inherent in almost all of Lovecraft's work. So I forgot what the original question was, but
no, that's great.
I've got another one for you.
What did I think would be better in the film? Oh. Okay, I'm gonna do everybody a solid and not say nothing. It was better. It was better than what I wrote. You know, so there you go.
Along those lines, what is the best reaction or compliment? What is the most ideal reaction or compliment to you after someone reads one of your scripts or sees a movie adaptation of one of your scripts? What fulfills you? What is a compliment that's most exciting to you?
I for a long time I used to say, and I say it still, although I've been fortunate to work with producers who are friends now, Brian's a friend, Barbara's a friend, Stuart was my best friend. But I always thought that my job was to write something that when the producer read it, they went, oh, that's great. We can't do that. That was it. And that determines where the line is. That's what you can't do. They're not going to pay you to put that on screen. But you have to know where the line is, because you have to go up to that line as often as you can in your script. You have to push that boundary as hard and as long as you possibly can in that script. Stuart's memoir just came out. Stuart's memoir is about his autobiographical memoir is about to come out in the middle of next month, I think, in the middle of November, from Fab Press in England. And pick it up. If you're interested in our films, pick it up. Nothing he says about me is true, but otherwise it's great. It's called A Naked Theater, An Uncensored Horror. And in it, he discusses all of these issues as well. You'll hear his take on it, which was one, as a collaborator, but two, also as somebody who knew he was going to be directing this. So there's a different mindset there. So you should try to get his perspective on that. But the original title of his memoir was More is More, not Less is More, More is More. Stuart was always about taking every scene as far as you could. Don't worry that you have to build the scenes up. You have to build to some, you know, terrible freak out, to some terrible, awful climax of the film. No, almost every scene has a climax in it. Every scene, you know, it might be a minor climax, but you're going to go all the way to that climax in that scene. You're going to go all the way there. So Stuart pushed me as a writer all the time. And because that was, it was what was said generally. I think the line comes from a review of one of the plays that he directed in his theater company, the Organic Theater in Chicago. Great, great theater. And they used to be a very narrative theater. They were a storytelling theater. They were in the great Chicago tradition of story theater. And actually going to see their productions, going to see their plays, was like going to see a movie. It was like seeing a live movie on stage. So I'm not surprised when Brian Usna saw Stuart's work that he suggested that, Stuart, you want to make, and Stuart was so ready. Stuart was just absolutely ready to direct when he direct a film when he got the chance. That whole idea that the reaction you want is, oh, that's too much, because you need to know where to go, what too much is, so that you go to just enough all the time.
So when you're coming up with your ideas for your films, like, what comes first? Is it the monster? Is it the kill? Is it the big spectacle? Or does it always start with the characters and the plot, and then that leads to the insanity? Or is it the insanity that is first?
It always started with the story. Stuart was a storyteller. He had a real profound talent for narrative. He knew where a story could go, and he knew, and looking at those options, he was great at figuring out where a story should go. I was about characters. I was trying to find what would the character do next? What would the character say next? Where would the character go next? I believe that I'm working on a successful script when the characters start telling me what they're going to say next. When I'm not imposing lines on them because they have to get to point B or point J or point X, they're telling me where they're going to go. And then I try to follow them. So writing a script is actually an act of writing a script or writing a story is an act of discovery. And we're trying to discover what the most horrifying thing is for those characters, because audience members should identify with the characters on screen and follow them. And what's frightening to those characters will be frightening, therefore, to the audience because of that identification. So we want to find it in the stories. And you have to have faith that you'll find it. If you're working with Lovecraft, you know, no brainer, you're going to find it, because the horror is embedded in, as I was just saying before, the horror is embedded in the characters, what the characters are afraid of becoming. Stuart and I did not want to tell stories about us versus them, about humans versus monsters, or humans versus invading aliens. That wasn't the interesting story to us. The interesting story to us was, you know, how do you struggle when the monster could be you? How do you struggle against becoming a monster yourself? I think that's a more universal story to tell and a more important one in many ways. So we didn't know that Reanimator was going to end the way Reanimator ends. You know, we followed the characters there. We didn't know From Beyond was going to go where From Beyond went. I mean, after the credit sequence, no idea where it was going to go. Let's follow those characters. Let's put those characters together in a haunted house situation and see what happens. A haunted house that opens up into cosmic horror. You know, there's something exciting about that kind of filmmaking. It's kind of, let's go. You know, it's kind of, and when the audience sits down, it's like, okay, follow us. Here we go. You know, don't trust us, but follow us. And we hope we don't disappoint. And I think we're less likely to disappoint than if we're jamming characters into a tale because there's a third act that we know we want to get to that, you know, because you lose your audience along the way because you're not being just to the characters. Although the fact is that does lead to storytelling problems. It leads to script writing problems. Because when you follow them and find that big reveal in the third act, when you find that more is most in the third act, when you finally have to show the creature, when you finally have to get to the Walpurgisnacht, you get there and then you discover, oh yeah, that would be great. That's terrific. Oh, these characters got there. And that's, oh, but to do that, we have to go back and change that thing in the first act. Or, you know, that character that we killed off or abandoned in the second act, you know, they actually need to come back here now. So we have to find a way that they survive that. You know, you have storytelling problems, but they're mechanical. You can deal with those. You need to find the characters and you need to find the ending, the satisfying, mad, but satisfying ending, and then retell your story. Writing is, it's true, writing is rewriting, but it's rediscovering as well at the same time.
We have a lot of emerging writers, directors who listen to this podcast, and something you said really, I mean, I've heard it before, but it struck me differently. The character finding a life of its own and then following that character. Do you have any practical strategies for other writers to get to that point? I mean, is it doing the morning routine of the character and seeing what they do? Is there any sort of exercises that help that character jump off the page so then you could start following them?
You know, because all the characters are different, again, to some degree, it's different in every script, in every writing adventure. But one thing you have to do as a writer is listen. A lot of writers don't listen very well because they're talking, you know, because they're writing, because the language is coming out of them. You need to listen to it, and you need to listen to your characters, and you need to ask questions. When this character goes here, you know, it's not, oh, this character has to do this next. It's what would this character do next? What might this character do next? And what are their motivations now? What are the changes that are happening in their lives? What are they thinking? You know, that's not going to come out in the dialogue, but it will come out. You have to have faith that it will come out on the screen, that it will come out in the telling of the tale. And then I'm going to have a small confession. One of the things I used to do, I can't quite do this anymore, even though now it's legal and it didn't used to be, is I would, you know, most people write in the morning when you have energy and coffee. You know, that's when you do your writing. It's not when everybody did their writing. I think I used to hear that Alfred Lord Tennyson, the poet, used to get up and answer mail in the morning, and then he would write poetry in the afternoon. Most people I know write in the morning. And then you go on. Then I would answer my email and go off and run errands and stuff. But what I do at night before I went to bed was I would smoke a joint, and then I would read what I had written that day. And you see it differently. You see and hear it differently because you've changed your mindset. The other way to do that, if you don't want to get stoned, who doesn't want to get stoned, is is to collaborate. You know, when you collaborate with somebody, they've got, you know, oh, no, I don't think the character would do that. And then you have to talk it through. You know, you get another, you get that other perspective, you get that other head on another body, on the body of somebody whose writing you trust and that you're happy to work with. I think I've collaborated with more people. I think I have the record for the most people collaborated with. You know, I have long collaborations with Stuart, but I have multiple collaborations with other people as well. And it was almost always productive. And it made me listen. You have to, you know, nobody likes to listen to other people, especially producers. When I used to get notes, it would be like, oh, God, those are so stupid. My friend Lenny Kleinfeld, who wrote scripts for a long time and now writes mystery novels. He didn't get produced. He was in Hollywood for a long time. He had the opposite career of mine. He wrote terrific scripts, made a lot of money, and almost none of them got produced. I worked almost entirely for minimum, and a bunch of my scripts got produced. But he used to say about notes is, you know, you get a note from a producer who says, why is everybody nude in this scene? Nobody's nude in the scene. Well, it doesn't say they're wearing clothes. It says he wipes his mouth with his sleeve. Oh, yeah. Well, write in that they've got clothes on. You know, I mean, some producers' notes are just way, way out there because they're not great readers. You know, they may be good at looking at dailies and letting you know whether they're good or not, but they're not great. They're not always great readers. And sometimes they're giving them to, you know, are they back to Gen A yet? You know, to some young, you know, reader who doesn't have a lot of experience and thinks it should be there, but wants to be a writer and thinks it should be this way. So you get a lot of notes at cross purposes with what you're doing, and some of them don't make any sense at all. If I do this and then I can't do that other thing that you liked 10 pages later. You know, so, you know, what you have to do, but you do have to listen to them. So put the script down, take a day, you know, go jog, come back, shower, and read the notes again. Because a couple of them are going to be good. A couple of them are going to open doors in the script that you didn't know you could open, that you didn't even know were there in the wall. And, you know, you need to know they're there. Even if you're not going to do that, you need to know they're there. And, you know, so let somebody else read your stuff. Let them read it and listen to them. Don't always do what they tell you, but listen to them because there might be good ideas. There might be brand new ideas. The best example is Joe Lynch gave me an idea that totally refreshed Suitable Flesh, that totally refreshed the scripts I had written for The Thing on the Doorstep, that made it, you know, new and shiny and wet for me. You know, it was, you know, his note was about the gender, swapping the gender roles. And it was like, wow, yeah. Because, you know, you schlep a script around for 25 years and you dig your heels in. You go, this is good, Bill, please. You know, you got to read this. This is good. And Joe said, do this. And I went, oh, man, that's different. And it made me see it and hear it. And do it differently. It was so worthwhile. So listen, and honestly listen.
That's actually a really interesting process to go through, because, you know, I've attempted to gender swap, you know, characters in my script before, but one time I tried and it just was like, this is not going to work at all. But I would love to hear your process. Like, how did you approach that? Do you write a whole new character, you know, or is it really the same character, but just their gender has changed? Like, how do you approach actually putting that into action?
Well, I changed the genders and I said, you know, I went back to the script, changed the genders and started to go scene by scene and see what worked and what didn't. It was remarkable how much worked, because in the Lovecraft story, there's gender swapping to begin with. There's the whole question of gender swapping to begin with. So it was fundamental to the story. It was just twisted the other way. So I twisted back, twisted into this form to give it one more twist. Didn't really change the fundamental dynamic of the story as much. It did change the characters. So I had to be, and, you know, spoiler alert, I'm a guy, and these are two female leads I'm writing. But as I said, I wrote a female lead for Barbara back in From Beyond, playing a psychiatrist, which is what the lead is in this film and what Barbara plays in the supporting role in this film as well. So I felt to some degree comfortable because I had a history doing that. And I knew it wasn't going to get done unless Barbara signed off on it. She was the producer. So I trusted Barbara to say, tell me, is this fair to its female characters? Is this script, you know, honest enough? And, you know, I mean, I had to listen. And she, you know, there were notes. I got notes and I took the notes seriously and it changed some of the character work. But the story is fundamentally the same. The characters are profoundly different, except for the malevolent ancient evil that threads its way through all of those identities. So it worked. We all ended up being happy with it.
Ark, I was going to jump us to the last few questions, but did you have another one?
I do. I have two, but like, let's just get these questions out of the way first. And then if there's time, then I can sneak mine in.
Yeah, there's time. I mean, I you know.
Thank you, Dennis. I'm going to jump to, actually, this is my favorite question. What's the best filmmaking advice or screenwriting advice you've ever heard or dispensed? We just want to share some wisdom with our listeners.
Well, it's William Goldman. Nobody knows anything. You know, I mean, there's no, it's true. Nobody, don't think you can't do something. What that means is don't think you can't do something. It sounds very negative. Nobody knows anything. But what it means is total freedom. You know, your imagination has total freedom. Go with it. Because it's never been on screen before means it should be on screen. Every movie should show you something you've never seen before. And, you know, we always tried to do that. So it was, it's good not to live. Don't put limits on yourself. Go. You know, you'll find, you know, the business will make limits for you. You will, you know, find what the limits are. But don't put limits on yourself to start with. And that's what I think Goldman, and that's certainly what I think Goldman believed in himself. So that's fundamentally the most important thing. You mean you'll never successfully start anything, and you certainly will never successfully finish anything unless you believe that. The other thing I believe is every good film is a happy accident. You can have the best script, you can have the best director, you can have the best producers, you can have the best crew, you can have the best conditions to film in, and the best actors, the best cast you could possibly cast, and the most money to work with, and you can make a clunker. It'll just, you know, lie there on the screen. And, you know, I mean, there's no guarantees here. So don't fight for money. Don't fight for, you know, certain characters. Don't fight for the right. Fight for the opportunity to do this and to be taken seriously. Fight for that. And then you give yourself a chance, which is the only thing you got. There's no guarantees. I have been incredibly fortunate to work with geniuses. And that's, you know, I guess my advice to anybody would be twofold. One, work with geniuses. Find other geniuses and work with them. Make friends with them and work with them. And the other is be lucky. Be really, really lucky. And that's
what's the worst filmmaking advice you've ever received?
That's a long list. You know, starting with, can't do that. Nobody's going to watch that. You know, I was talking about this earlier, well, before we started the podcast, but I have a brand. You know, horror humor is kind of my brand. Well, you want to know something? I've worked outside that brand a number of times. And this film, Suitable Flesh, pushes that brand over into the noir, over into noir as well, and a little softcore. You know, so, you know, there's brands, you know, don't believe that. There is no brand. There are just stories to tell. You know, find the story and tell that story. Find the characters and follow those characters. Don't, you know, don't say, you know, I got to do this and I got to do that. It's worked for a lot of people. Yeah, you know, it's worked for Clive Barker and, you know, Rob Zombie and, you know, those, you know, and for great filmmakers. You know, it worked for Tobe Hooper and it worked for John Carpenter. Although John Carpenter makes all kinds of films. So, you know, I mean, yeah, that's worked, but don't believe it, because I don't think any of those guys believe it either. They make the movies that they feel they want to make. And so there, yes, you're working in a genre, but genres are there to, like rules. Genres have rules. And what are rules made for? To be broken. You know, find where they break. Find where there's that door in the wall that you never saw before and go through that.
If you could go back in time, what's the piece of advice you'd give yourself?
Don't do quite as much cocaine as you did in the 80s. Don't, you know, that.
That's not the first time we've heard that.
That, yeah, yeah. 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 You know, well, when I first got to Hollywood, you know, the archetype that I, you know, stereotype, the Hollywood stereotype was, you know, you go out in Hollywood to write and there's a bowl of cocaine next to the keyboard. And, you know, there's, you know, and afterwards you'll go smoke with starlets and it'll be great. And when I got to L.A., it was, you ever see the, you know, when I got to L.A., it was bottled water, you know, it was Evian water and clean living and going to the gym. And it was like, what happened? Where's the cocaine? So it was like, so happily I lived in New York where it was plentiful. But, you know, if I had to go back and do it again, I would not, you know, I said that, you know, drugs helped me, but, you know, collaborators helped me more than drugs. Other people, you know, the terrible thing about film is it's collaborative. You have to work with other people. But the wonderful thing about film is it's collaborative. You get to work with other people. So take as much advantage of that as possible.
And last question, is writing movies hard?
Hard as hell. Yeah, it's very difficult. Writing good movies is probably even harder, although I couldn't tell you how to do that. I just write the movies and somebody else makes them good. But yes, it's difficult work. You run into those walls all the time. I've got, you know, as I said, I got a drawer full of scripts, unfinished stories and scripts that ran into that third act where I couldn't figure it out, just could not figure it out. It is, you know, there's a story in there someplace that somebody's going to tell. And a couple of times other people did, you know, they took the story that we thought we were going to tell and they told it in a different way. You know, that's, yes, it's hard. And sometimes it's so hard that sometimes you fail. You fail to do a good job. You fail to finish, to find it. You fail to discover, you know, the stories of the great discoveries in adventures and in science, they're just the pinnacle of a mountain of failed discoveries, of failures to discover. But don't let that, you know, and it's easy to get discouraged. It is really easy to get discouraged. Don't get discouraged. You know, find what encourages you and try to find it in the story itself and try to tell that. But, you know, that's the other thing that's hard about script writing is it's hard to find encouragement elsewhere. It's hard to find people who are going to encourage you. Writing is indeed a lonely business. And I've been lucky to collaborate, which is why collaborating has worked so well for me. But I've written a number of scripts on my own, including the one for Suitable Flesh. Although, as I told you, Joe gave me good notes. Barbara gave me good notes. I got good feedback that helped. You know, take the help where you find it. But, you know, a lot of writing is spent alone staring at a screen. And that's you get trapped in it sometimes. And it's that the screen doesn't encourage you. The screen doesn't encourage you back. The screen, you know, you all of a sudden you find yourself on some other social media site or, you know, watch streaming something and you're escaping. You know, that's not encouragement. But finding, you know, and you need to find a way to encourage yourself. And usually it's in the story itself. Let the characters talk to you. Let this love the stories that you tell. Tell the stories that you love.
Amazing. I don't think we have time for the deep question that I want to ask in 3 minutes.
Go ahead, ask it. If we don't have time, I'll tell you.
Okay. Well, so you wrote, like, you know, had 5 films produced in the mid-80s to the 90s. And you had 5 more produced in the first half of the 90s. So the question is, like, after all those horror features being made, what kept bringing you back to horror? Like, what kept drawing you back to this genre?
Well, as I said, it was when, you know, from a kid, I always loved, from high school, from when I started to, read for myself, when at some point, some age you are, when you're a teenager, you start to choose what to read for yourself. I read sci-fi, and sci-fi slides you right into Lovecraft and horror and fantasy fiction. So it was an early love. One, working with Stuart. Stuart was the youngest old guy I knew. Stuart always tried to stay young. When Stuart ran a film a film festival at the University of Wisconsin where we were students. When Stuart ran a film club, he showed the films that he loved when he was a kid. And that's, you know, that sticks with you. You know, it doesn't go away. Be honest to yourself. You know, I found other things I love. I love great literature. But, you know, I taught Gothic fiction at Hunter College of the City of New York for 20 years. That was my day job. And, you know, it's great literature. But Gothic fiction is great literature. There's no reason to abandon something that is terrific, that you love and keeps, you know, and there are great writers of Gothics today. You know, Stephen King, Anne Rice, Clive Barker, you know, Neil Gaiman, there's, you know, great work being done. So, you know, why abandon it? It's all out there all around me. And I, you know, I always loved it. It's not that, I love all kinds of things. You know, again, I don't want to be branded because, you know, I was talking about Tennyson before. I love poetry, but I'm not a poet. So, you know, I do write stories and those are often the stories that, you know, because I'm sort of swimming in that sensibility. Those are the stories that suggest themselves. So those are the ones I'm attracted to. But I have other stories I want to tell. Stay tuned, everybody. I have other stuff coming. I have other stuff that's going to be out there. So watch. Nice. Wait and watch.
Advertise for the movie. When should people go see this movie? How can they support the film?
It's actually going to get a limited theatrical release. If you can see Suitable Flesh on a big screen, do it. Joe is, I was talking earlier about Stuart being a painter on screen. His frames are paintings. Joe is a filmmaker. Joe is, you know, going back the history of film. He knows every trick that you can do with a camera. And he doesn't pull them all out, but he pulls out the ones that work for this story. It is a master class in filmmaking. So if you can see it on, if you love film, see it on a big screen. It comes out on November 27th. October 27th. Hey, it's Halloween. It's our season. And it comes out October 27th to a screen. I don't know where it'll be, so I don't know if it'll be near you. But if it's not, drive and find it. But it'll start streaming then too. I think it streams on Shudder for sure. And I'll probably find it on another couple of streaming services. Suitable Flesh, directed by Joe Lynch, written by me. And it was fun. It was fun for 25 years living with that story. And it's great fun to see it made.
Do you love Making Movies as Hard and you want to listen to more episodes?
Jump over to our Patreon page at patreon.com/MMIH and you can listen to the entire back catalog of episodes for just $1.99 a month.
That's an additional 300 episodes that aren't on iTunes that you can listen to whenever you please.
But without any more blibber blabber, back to the show.
All right, we haven't talked to Dennis Powell yet. We're talking to him tomorrow. But what are you excited to talk to him about?
Oh, man. Well, I really want to hear from him about, it's probably irrelevant information, but I still want to hear the story about like how he got started as a writer. I think like that's always like really interesting to me. Like, how do you get from, you know, being somebody who writes things to like being somebody who has movies produced that end up being fan favorites for 20, 30 years? You know, like how does that go? Like, where's the jump, you know? So I want to ask about that. I also want to hear about how he structures his stories and his scripts and like how he approaches writing, because I feel like it's really interesting, like when you're sitting down to write something, like what is in your mind and like what are you thinking about? Like, and like, especially in movies where there's like kills and like practical effects and crazy monsters and things, like what comes first? Is it the story and the characters or is it the crazy monster? You know, like what is the origin of this idea and how is it formed? You know, so I'm really interested to talk to him about those things. What about you, Liz? Anything in specific you want to talk about?
No, but I have From Beyond on Laserdisc, and that is how we say it. That is how we say the name of the film. We have like kind of an inside joke with a few friends where like you can't not say it that way. So I just want to hear him say the title in a normal way.
So I had seen Reanimator, and then I like watched a bunch of other like these grindhouse horror, you know, movies from that era, and then I watched From Beyond like maybe 3 years ago for the first time, and man, that movie is rad. Oh, it's so rad.
Yeah.
And I think I watched it either while I was watching a ton of Joe Bob, or even maybe there was a Joe Bob episode where they watched it. I can't remember if what it was. like, but it was around the era. Like, I was just like watching Joe Bob like once a week, and then I was watching as many movies on Shudder as I could. And so that was like my headspace, and it was the perfect headspace to be in to watch that movie. So good.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So this week is time to do another round of You're the Expert. And I figured, since we're both writers who have written horror movies, and we have a writer who has written many, many really amazing horror movies on the show, that we should talk about our approaches to writing horror movies. So, like, when you start a script, like, basically what we were just talking about, like, where, what do you start with? Like, do you have, like, all the kills in mind? Do you have the set piece in mind? Or is it more like you have these characters and this kind of concept, and then you build all the kills and the other things in? Like, how do you approach it?
Well, I've only written two horror-related things, and they both are horror comedy. And I've learned the hard way through these two projects that I'm not a straight horror writer, and I'm not... Either I'm incapable, or it's, I have no interest in that, because I will think that I'm writing straight horror, and then someone will read it and they will tell me it is horror comedy, and I will think, oh, you're right, that is funny. Like, I don't know how to write things that are just scary. But for Witchy was inspired by an episode of Bob's Burgers, which is a comedy, and Best Friends Forever, which is a horror comedy. It was inspired by a dream I had. But ultimately, themes are what pushes me forward in a project, right? So Witchy is about infidelity and about standing up for yourself. And Best Friends Forever is about the intimacy of friendship, the regained intimacy of friendship for these characters. And so that's what pushes me through. And Amy and I wrote Best Friends Forever. And the reason I can answer this question is because we have like 80 drafts of this script where we tried different stories, different kills, different magic, different rules, different genre references. There's a witch version. There's like a weird, surreal Suspiria version. There's like various different versions of this film. But what carried us through were the characters and the theme, not necessarily the plot. Right. So we don't start with kills. We start with like, what is this movie about? And then who are each of these characters? And I always have to have like someone in real life. Sometimes, not always, I sometimes really need a real life corollary for the character in order for me to write about it. But I never think my kills are final until I talk to a special effects person. And then I rewrite the kills around what is best. What about you? Do you think of really good kills? Because I cannot.
Oh, well, for Brother, the whole kind of idea kind of came to me all at once, really. And it was all based about my brother-in-law and my sister-in-law's boyfriend at the time. And so it was sort of like also based on real people, you know, but like in a very kind of different, loose way. Except although the boyfriend character in the movie actually says things that the real life boyfriend actually said. So it's like, it was kind of, in that case, it was really close. But like, I think like what, for the kill for that movie, the monsters eat people, right? So like, it was pretty easy for me to like, imagine like what I'd want that kill to be, and just like a nice head chomp or a head, well, I can't remember if it originally was supposed to be like that the monster came and just like bit the head off, or if it was always a head rip. But what we ended up doing was a head rip, which was really cool. And then he you know, he eats the head, which was really awesome. I don't know if you ever saw that short.
Is there like, does the skull get crushed, or like, do you see that?
So, yeah, it's like a head rip, and you see part of the head rip from behind. So we had like a torso that we had a head attached to, and then like we had blood on the inside. And then the main shot of the monster was always thought of to be like a silhouette of like the shadow of the of it opening up. Or, well, I guess it wasn't a shadow. It was an actual silhouette. So like it's in front of a projector. So like you're supposed to just see just the outline of the creature open its mouth. And, you know, so there's no bone crunching, because like the way the creature opens, it like super widens its jaw to get the whole head in.
Yeah.
So there's no real skull crushing involved. It's more just like a big one swallow, like you're eating a candy drop, you know, but it's actually a head. Yeah. So that one I think was already kind of formed from before. And then I'm like thinking about the movie I'm writing now, which is also a horror comedy, but it's got like some, it's like very like, you know, 80s, like big kind of explosion, blood explosion sort of stuff. Mm. And I think I always knew for one of the kills, I always knew the way I wanted it to open, which is like, I won't ruin it, but like, because that was already in my mind. But I think as I've been writing it, they just kind of come, you know, like they just sort of come from the way that the story is unfolding. And then I also guess it's also just like thinking about like the situation they're going to be in and how the thing that's happening to them, like the mutation or the transformation or whatever, the sci-fi element, this thing that's like turning them into a monster, like how is that gonna, you know, develop within the situation the character is in? And mm-hmm. so like when you like okay, like for one example, like there was two options of what I was gonna have my lead character do. Like he was either gonna go to a business meeting or he was gonna go to an amateur boxing match. And I was like really unsure like what I wanted him to be doing that day that like is that he has to deal with while he's transforming. And I ended up, I think what I'm going to do is the boxing match. And so then that kill kind of works itself out, because if you're like imagining like you're in a amateur boxing match, like how is that monster, the monster, you know, thing going to develop? And then what's going to happen? Like it's related to plot. I immediately see it in my mind of like how it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, oh, it's all right. It wrote itself, you know? And same with like the alternate too, like the kill in that movie. Like, I think I always knew that I wanted it to be this thing where, you know, it was kind of involuntary. Like it wasn't like the one character killed the other character. It's like they kind of did it to themselves. And so once I kind of knew what that was and I knew how the portal would work, it was like kind of obvious to me, like how it was going to happen. But I guess it's not really, that's so funny, because it's like for you, it's obvious. But like anyone else, like coming up with this would like think of it some completely different way. They'd be like, that, why would that be obvious? You know? But I guess that's just how it works.
Well, it sounds like plot and character lead both of us. And that makes a lot more sense. I think I was thinking back, I remember pitching to a horror production company a few years ago and talking to them about how I wanted the gore and the horror elements to be treated in the film. And there was something kind of, I felt very like embarrassed by the conversation afterwards. I was like, I really want the gore to be beautiful and shiny and squishy. And like, I realized that I was like, in a way, maybe they were the right terms, but it felt like I was romanticizing things in the pitch that felt off. Like, I think when you talk about gore and violence in movies and you're with the wrong audience or the wrong conversation partner, people might think that you don't take real life violence seriously, right? So it's like, and I think the same thing can happen as a writer, is like if you are kill driven rather than story and character driven, then you're not really taking the gravity of the violence seriously either, right? Because it's like you're just like, oh, I just want to see this character die and this character die, and not really about story or character.
Well, to me, it's like two completely different mindsets. You know, like there's the mindset where it's like you're coming up with a fun over the top kill that's gonna like, you know, make an audience in a theater like erupt, you know, with like oohs, ahs, and maybe even laughter in some cases, you know.
But that's not why you make the movie.
No, it's not why you make the movie. But like if you're talking about the violence, like I think it's very different if you're making that type of movie than like if you're trying to like, oh, I'm seriously considering the violence and the impact of it and how terrible it is. It's like the simple act, like a very good example is like Unforgiven. Mm. Like the way that they the weight that they put behind killing somebody and like all the conversation. And then when the young character finally does kill his first person, like the impact of it and the way that Clint Eastwood's character talks about how it is to kill a person and how terrible it is, you know, and how like he only did it when he was drunk and that it was like this terrible thing that weighs on him. It's just like that's one way of looking at it. But then you go to like a Bruce Willis action movie and like people are dying every 5 seconds, you know, and no one cares, you know, and people just kill people because it's an action movie, you know, blam, they're dead, you know. So it's like it's like completely different context.
Well, I feel think like I'm just wary of being gleeful about talking about it in some way. Like, I don't want to be gleeful.
No, but that's, I think being gleeful about the violence in the right circumstances is actually a good thing.
It's probably because,
because there is a little bit of like, maybe I'm terrible for saying this, but there is a little bit of glee when it comes to like a kill in like Evil Dead or especially Army of Darkness.
Yeah.
Like the kills in that are just designed to be fun and silly and ridiculous, you know? Half the time they're zombies, right? Or the deadites, but like, it's like all those kills are fun and there is a glee to that, right? But like, I think you're totally right, because in the wrong room with the wrong people, like they don't understand that.
Okay.
And then they're like, this person's a sicko, you know? But it's
I'm more interested in making people grossed out than like, I think I've talked about this ad nauseum, so I'm so sorry, but that scene in Drag Me to Hell in the car with the old woman, and it's Alison Pill, right? It's the girl.
Mm-hmm.
Is
Alison Pill? I think so.
No, it's Alison Lohman. I always get Alison Pill and Alison Lohman, but they're in the car and there's like snot coming out of the old woman's nose as they're struggling with each other. Like that is like pinnacle of cinema to me, is like, can the kill be gross? Can you make it as gross as possible? And I think that's why I land in horror comedy, because gross is usually in the comedy world. Like you're always thrown out of your comfort zone laughing at your discomfort, right? But
yeah.
But I just am acknowledging my own itchiness talking about violence, where I'm not fully fledged in the world yet where I can be like, yeah, I can't wait to rip off her arms. Like I don't think I'd ever say that yet.
Well, yeah, it's funny. It's like all context, because like in my movies, usually the person who's dying deserves it, you know. And so it's like there, it's like then it feels good. It's almost like in the end of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where you know there's those terrible kills. But like they're such terrible people that you're like happy to see them die in this crazy way. But then I know people also really struggle with that because it's so over the top and like it's so played for the like the glory of their killings that people have a hard time with that, you know. But like to me, that's the point of the movie. So, you know, I don't know. Anyways, this is a much longer conversation that we could have at a later date. But I think that's all very fascinating, very interesting. I'm really curious to hear what people think, like in your pitches for horror movies, like how do you handle the violence? Like, are you leaning into it and getting really excited describing all the deaths? Or are you like being really respectful and like, you know, not like getting too excited talking about the way that you're going to kill your characters?
I like that.
So if you have thoughts on this, please send us a comment, question, or suggestion to podcast@mickeymoviesishard.com. Or if you really love the show, give us a review on iTunes. That would be quite lovely. You can also check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMIH Podcast and YouTube at Mickey Movies is Hard Podcast. Make sure to check out the International Screenwriters Association. They're the ISA. It's an organization designed to connect writers with filmmakers through a number of programs they offer, including publishing your logline to a network of industry professionals, consultation courses, contests, and of course, their top 25 writers list, featuring some of their best writers. So head over to www.networkisa.org to sign up for free today. Thanks to Dennis Powley for coming on the show. Thanks to Donella Lawless from Katrina Juan PR for setting this whole thing up. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Reimuth, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert Jones for handling all of our social media and always coming up with really cool ideas. Thanks so much, Robert Jones. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for simply being awesome. Thanks to you all for listening, and we'll talk to y'all next week. Yeah, I think without further delay, we should get into the next thing that you should do, which is, that was terrible. Oh my God.